Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Greece was rocked with reports over the weekend about secret plans by a faction of the anti-austerity Syriza party to possibly transform the currency from the euro to the drachma. Former Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis and former Energy Minister Panagiotis Lafazanis gave separate interviews over the weekend, revealing that a plan B was set into place months earlier in case Greece needed a way out of the eurozone quickly. Varoufakis lambasted some media reports for giving the erroneous impression that he was plotting against the state so as to justify charges of treason against him. Negotiators from the EU are expected in Athens this week to discuss details of a new bailout plan to the tune of 68 billion euros. Joining me now is Richard Wolff. He has written a number of books, including Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, and Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown. He is an acclaimed economist. Welcome to Uprising, Richard Wolff.
Thank you very much, Sonali. Glad to be here.
Now, news media are using the words humbled and capitulation to describe the current state of the Greek crisis. Is it too soon to use these words, or is it pretty much over? Has the much-vaunted anti-austerity Syriza party been forced to give in?
Well, the answer is, as usual with good questions, a little yes, a little no. Is it a defeat for Greece? Absolutely. It was a decision led by Mrs. Merkel in Germany, but with the agreement of most of the leaders of Europe, that they are going to impose a savage austerity on the Greek people. They are going to literally destroy a small, poor part of Greece in order to force it to do two things. One, to pay back all the debts that were pushed onto Greece in the years, particularly since the crisis of 2008, but before that as well. And secondly, to carry out the notion that austerity, making the mass of people pay for the costs of economic crises and bailouts, is the way Europe has decided to deal with its problems. It is awful. It is an attempt by the rich to destroy the poor by making them pay for the problems of the system and doing it without any compassion, without any mercy. Let me give you a clear example that I think will help Americans. When the crash hit here in 2008, it began with the incapacity of millions of Americans to pay their mortgages. They had borrowed more than they could afford because their wages had not risen in any real way for 30 years, because banks had inveigled them with all kinds of illegal and immoral activities for which they've paid a few small fines recently. And so masses of Americans found themselves ripped up between an economy that wouldn't pay them anymore and the debts that same economy put on them. We made a few half-hearted efforts in this country to help the people who couldn't afford their mortgages, but millions of them lost their homes with a traumatic effect on their wages, on their family life, on their children's education, things that we will be suffering from as an economy for years to come. The thing that happened in Europe is exactly the same, except instead of focusing on people who couldn't pay their mortgages, it's been organized in a national way. Imagine if all the subprime mortgagees who couldn't pay were Greek citizens, had some common ethnicity. They didn't, of course, in this country, but that's what's happening in Europe. You're focusing on a particular country, Greece, and trying to smash them by saying to them, we fooled you into taking loans you couldn't afford, we kept down your wages so you couldn't afford them, and now we're punishing you for not paying back, and we're going to make you pay back, even if it means your ruin and the ruin of everyone associated with you for decades to come. It is a very tragic moment in European history.
Now, Richard Wolff, the government spokesperson who has been credited or tasked, I should say, with justifying the situation to the Greek people, Lefteris Kretsos, gave an interview where he essentially said austerity is bad, but bankruptcy is much worse. But so that's the big question. Would bankruptcy have been much worse?
Well, you know, it's one of those wonderful questions we'll never know, at least for the moment, because they didn't dare try. I think a more honest answer would be to say that, led again by Mrs. Merkel in Germany, the Germans and the rest of the European leadership were prepared to starve Greece out, to literally deny the people and the businesses of Greece the money, the euro, which is their common currency, needed to do everything from buy a quart of milk at the store, to run your business, to help a friend with a check, whatever needed money. They were basically, as Mr. Varoufakis correctly said, they were asphyxiating the Greek people financially. So what you forced the politician there to do was to choose between doing what they want in the way of austerity, cutting wages, cutting salaries, cutting public services, which is what they've now agreed to do, or going into an unknown situation where you would have to try to figure out, with very little time, how to substitute a whole nother payment system for the fact that the euro would be no longer available to the Greek people to use.
And so that actually brings me then to this question of what you make of this plan that was revealed over the weekend that had been apparently worked on and put into place by Varoufakis and a small group of folks, kept super secret, where they essentially tried to create the infrastructure, and I think might have successfully created the infrastructure for a parallel economy that would, with the flip of a switch overnight, have switched from the euro to the drachma, at least theoretically, with very little, problem and with problems with transition. What do you make of this news?
Well, again, it is a bit of a tempest in a teapot. Let me explain. Every government that has even a little bit of a sense of history and responsibility has the task of trying to figure out how to plan for as many contingencies as are reasonable in its own future. For example, the American Defense Department makes contingency plans for probably bombing or invading virtually every country on this planet in order to have those plans available if, and that's the big word, if political and economic and military conditions put that on the agenda. It was the responsibility of Mr. Tsipras' government, as indeed it was the responsibility of governments in Greece before Mr. Tsipras and Syriza, to have in place contingency plans so that a government that had to make difficult and perhaps sometimes time-pressured decisions would have the knowledge of how to go about doing it. Not to do that is irresponsible. All that Mr. Tsipras and Syriza did through the finance minister, which was the right way to do it, was to say, look, there is a chance, and boy, is this true, and everybody who follows this knew it, if there's a chance that the Europeans will push us to the brink, try to force us into this austerity policies they prefer by literally taking away our money, our euro, our access to the euro, we ought to have a plan B. We ought to have a way to deal with that. And so what the plan B was, and there Mr. Varoufakis used an American economics professor, James Galbraith, from the University of Texas in Austin, to help him design a possible way, if the Europeans chose to take away the money, and if the Greek government in response chose to move to another currency, that they would have the way, the mechanisms, the understanding to do that. There's an added wrinkle. When you change from one currency to another, it has to be done in secrecy and suddenly. You can't tell people and businesses that you're going to change from one currency to another, because what they then all do, what all Greeks would have done who had the capacity, would be to stock up on euros as much as they could, pull them out of circulation, in order then to cash them back into the new currency once it was established. That would have made the shortage of euros for the economy to function 10 times worse, literally overnight, and would have brought to be the very asphyxiation the Europeans were doing slowly in a quick way, and that's why it was kept secret. I should also remind folks that in the history of the last 50 years, when countries in various circumstances have substituted one currency for another, it has always been prepared in secret, and it has always been done suddenly, precisely because of these risks.
Now, we have been covering this situation in Greece for a long time. In fact, the last time you were on our program in studio, we started talking about it quite early on when the Syriza party won its election. And they were elected because of the promise that they represented to the Greek people, because the sense was that the Greek people had basically been pushed too far. The situation in Greece being compared to that under the U.S.'s Great Depression. If it's true that they have been pushed as far as they can be pushed in terms of austerity cuts, and if the troika of creditors are now imposing even harsher austerity cuts than they first offered to Greece, how is that going to go down, practically speaking? I know that some of the details haven't been worked out yet, but the troika of creditors are standing pretty strong. But can the Greek people take any more?
Well, you know, that is the $64 billion, or maybe these days I should say trillion-dollar question. The way to understand this, I think, is to go for a minute to a different place, but it's the same issue. Imagine you're sitting in a room full of the board of directors of some large corporation. If you go to such meetings, as I have done a few times in my life, you very quickly understand that there are basically two opinions. One opinion of the board of directors is we can push and squeeze our workers forever. They are pliant, they are cowardly, they are fearful for their jobs. So we can take away their benefits, we can cut their pensions, we can reduce their lunch time to 20 minutes, we can allow them less than two times to go to the bathroom during the day. We can make them work harder and harder, and there's no reason for us not to. It will enhance our profits. On the other hand, there are always, or almost always, at least a few members of the board of directors who reason in a different way. They look at their fellow members of the board of directors and they say, don't be foolish. You can push people so far. We have pushed our workers quite a ways and we're doing very well and making a lot of money. You are going to push so hard that you are going to go across a line. No one knows exactly where the line is, but you're going to push our workers to the point where they're going to revolt. And then it's not going to be a question of us getting a little more or a little less profit. You're going to throw the entire enterprise's survival up for grabs. So take a good profit. Be glad that you've squeezed the workers successfully as far as you have, but don't push further. What the Greeks did with Europe, they assumed that there were enough people in the leading councils of Europe arguing that you've pushed the Greek people far enough, you've made them suffer, you've given them a 25% unemployment rate, you've cut the wages of public employees, who are the majority in Greece, by over 40% since 2010, etc. That's enough. Don't push them further, because it is going to make them into a revolutionarily angry group, and that will infect the similarly suffering Spanish people, right, Portuguese people, and so on. And the mistake that the Greek government made was it, and by the way, workers make this mistake all the time. They misunderstand that there are simply, in these days, not enough of the kinds of friends on the board of directors as opposed to enemies. What they learned, the Greeks learned in Europe, was that Mrs. Merkel, her finance minister, Schauble, these are people who have no intention of giving up their sense that they're on the ascendancy. They've been pushing people around in Europe nicely now for 15 years. They're not about to stop, and they brush aside the more hesitant European leaders, for example, the socialist Hollande in France, and will have nothing to do with him, and they have the majority. And so the question is only how far further will they push the Greeks, not whether they will, but how far they will, and at what point the Greek people, and indeed the Spanish and the Italians, will say no. And there are already signs, particularly interestingly in Italy over the last 3 days, in which leading politicians are beginning to say, hey, if this is the way Europe is going to work, given what it's done to Greece, maybe it would be wiser for us to get out now before they do it to us as well.
Well, let's talk about another people, and that is the American people. Richard Wolff, you're in New York, where a major, major victory was won last week when the Fight for 15 campaign in New York, which was sort of the birthplace of this wave of activism demanding higher wages for fast food workers, was born. And in New York, in statewide, a measure was adopted to raise the wages. In the city of New York, wages would rise faster to reach $15 an hour. How important was this victory?
Well, I think it has two important consequences. The first one, which any decent person would applaud, is that it takes people who have very hard jobs and get paid very little and makes them less awfully paid than they were. To live in New York City, for those of your listeners who are not familiar, is a very expensive proposition. Prices in New York City for a whole range of things are higher than they are anywhere else in the United States. So to be honest, one has to say that to do a 40-hour a week job and earn $15 an hour is going to make you have a difficult economic row to hoe. To earn less than that is an indignity to the human being and should never have been allowed in the first place. So I am happy that people who should have been paid more than this are at least going to get the $15, which living in New York City, and for that matter in New York State, but particularly in the city, is just a matter of basic human decency. But even more important for me is that this was a campaign that was roundly dismissed by all kinds of people as hopeless, impossible, much too ambitious, not taking into account that people don't want to get active politically, they are not in a mood, they're fearful of losing the job they have. 800 reasons, very old, very stale, very frequently repeated, why such an effort wouldn't work. So for me, who sees so many other efforts like this screaming for the same kind of response of people, I am very happy and believe that this will inspire others. Let's remember, for example, that there are many people who earn below $15 an hour, but that do not work in the fast food industry. They are not yet covered by any comparable political agreement. So they're immediately, obviously, in need. But even beyond that, let's remember that, you know, to raise the wages of a person, however valuable and important, and of course we all support it, still doesn't change something very fundamental about our economic system, which is that a tiny group of people at the top, the boards of directors and major shareholders of corporations, are making all the decisions, including the decision of how much to pay people, for the vast majority. That is an anti-democratic arrangement.
Which is why the second part of that demand, which is for a union, has not been won. It was fight for $15 an hour and a union, right?
Exactly. A union would help make the following a reality. if you allow the people, the tiny group of people at the top, to make the decisions, then even if you win, as has been won now, $15 an hour, it would be naive not to understand that those boards of directors and those major shareholders, they will be going back to Governor Cuomo in New York and to the legislature. They are not going to stop because they lost this battle and not continue to fight the war. They may move production out of the city. They may find ways to escape all of these rules. That's what they do, and they have the resources to do it. So working people need not only to have a higher wage, but they need to have some security about that, and a union will give them at least a little more than if they don't have a union. But I would like to make the further point that if we had, and I think we need the courage now to demand this, if we had a democratic way of organizing businesses so that the majority of people would be in a position in a working place to control these things, then it wouldn't be in the hands of people we know don't want to do this for us, because they haven't for years, who we know will try to undo whatever we win. If the people themselves in cooperatives and things like that operated and owned the work sites, the workplaces, we wouldn't be in this absurd position where we have to struggle and strain to get things that should never have been that low in the way of wages in the first place.
Dr. Richard Wolfona, thank you so much, as always, for joining us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Sonali. And Maya, congratulations to you for having the courage to put these issues forward for people to listen and think about.
Dr. Richard Wolf is a visiting professor in the graduate program at the International Affairs and teaches international affairs at the New School University in New York. His books include Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. This is Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar.